Today's talk is given by Professor Fouki Hackley, Professor of Geographical Information Science at University College London. His talk is entitled VGI and Citizen Science, What We Know and What Next. What next? Professor Hackley holds a BSc in Computer Science and Geography and both an MA and PhD in Geography. In 2001, he joined UCL as a lecturer and was promoted to professor in 2011. He is the co-director of UCL Extreme Citizen Science Group, EXCITES, and works on a range of research projects that involve participatory mapping and participatory science methods. His research interests include public access to environmental information and the way in which the information is used by a wide range of stakeholders, citizen science, and in particular applications that involve community-led investigation, development and use of participatory GIS and mapping, and human-computer interaction, HCI, for geospatial technologies. Who better, therefore, to guide us through the world of VGI and citizen science, and we thus look forward to a most engaging seminar.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and I hope that we will have an interesting conversation. So, what I want to cover today is this issue of volunteer geographical information. For a lot of people that are coming from GIS background, this concept is somewhat familiar, but I won't assume too much, so I'll give you a quick overview of that. Then I'll move into an area that is less familiar, which is citizen science, and give you an overview of what is this thing that's called citizen science and what we find in that. And we'll look also at the overlap between the two areas. Once we understood VGI, citizen science, we can then think about what GIS science can do to the area of citizen science, how it can contribute, and the other way around, what kind of things we can learn by engaging with all the activities of citizen science. And something that I do on both parts, both on the VGI and on the citizen science, is looking at trends. Now, trends is things that lead to a change and can help us expand and make sense of it. The problem with trends is that actually proving that this trend led to this result, causality, is impossible. And also even just trying to say that this percentage of the changes caused by this trend is also almost impossible in the kind of social technical trends that I'm doing. So you can take it with a pinch of salt and say, actually you got it wrong, and think about your trend. Though the trend that I'm presenting in both parts, in the first part of the talk, are there in order for us to think about what made the difference. So the first thing that we need to understand about the whole area of volunteer geographical information is this whole concept of web mapping 2.0, which is kind of things have changed somewhere around 2005. And the reason that you know this change is because people started inventing new words and new terms, and there are new websites, a new system. And actually, if we now look back at this period and look at the past, at the last 10 years, there wasn't a huge change since then. So indeed, something big happened at that time. And those are the four trends that we will look at and that influence this thing. It's GPS availability, internet and especially broadband access, cost of storage, which is extremely important for geographical information, and the growth in smartphones. We'll see that. For me, this thing is, people tend to forget it, but if you want to celebrate the date when the world really changed, this day of the 1st of May 2000, when someone practically flicked the switch. It's someone somewhere in the GPS command flicked the switch and removed selective availability and made it possible for everything that we see now to happen. Because before that, GPS, a good GPS receiver, even the one that would just give you something like 100 meter accuracy, would cost you between $500 and $1,000. Because the number of people that needed it and could rely on it was relatively small, so there wasn't point in creating so many chips and other things. Nowadays, the cost of GPS chips is so small that you can buy them and you can plug them into lots of devices. And if it wasn't for that, then we might, if that didn't happen in 2000, it might have happened later, it might have happened through Galileo. But it wouldn't happen, when it happened, we wouldn't see the changes that we see now. And I completely agree with you. It's kind of, it's a really prophetic view from Neil Lane when he was talking about the change in selective availability. It's particularly the change in the GPS from accuracy that is 100 meter to the accuracy that we have today, that you can take the phone and get your accuracy down to a meter. The next thing that need to be aware of is the internet. Everyone knows that the internet provides. You'll see a lot of examples of how the web and the internet change things. And the big change is these things. If you look around 2005, you'll see that in Europe, in the US, it's kind of past the 50%. It's more than 50% of the population. It's not anymore the early adopters or the very techy people that are in that. It become a mass participation of society. And there is still a way to go in parts of the world. And that is important. Even in, we'll see later on, that even when we're talking about the developing world, in the UK, there is still 25% of people that haven't accessed the internet, and interviews with them show that they don't see a reason to go online. So that's, you know, there is still gaps going on. But that kind of change, that you have mass participation, but one of the interesting changes is the difference between dial-up and broadband. So again, the kind of things that we are delivering over the web nowadays, and the whole ability of doing Google Maps, even, which Google Maps work by creating lots of image files and then sending them over the internet. When in 2003, 2004, I was doing with one student an evaluation of how long it takes you to digitize a 5 points polygon on a dial-up when you are at home with, you know, the regular modems. To digitize 5 points would take you 2 minutes. In the way that you digitize something, it goes back to the server, send you the point, etc. And even if you do it with JavaScript, once you send it, it would take you a very long time. So that was basically impossible to do anything with the web until you got the broadband. The side story that is interesting about the broadband is that it's a side effect of the dot-com crash. Because one of the things that people don't notice, so dot-com was a crash in the 2000s when all the excitement about internet companies that went on from the 1993, 4 until 2000 kind of completely collapsed. But one thing that happened during this period is that some companies borrowed a lot of money to put in fiber optics across Europe and across Britain and across the US. Now, when these companies collapsed, they had to sell their assets. The assets were the cable. Suddenly, instead of the T1 connection, which was the gold standard around 2000, it cost you a lot of money to rent it, suddenly it cost nothing. And that's enabled you, you know, with the other technological innovation, enabled us to see this huge growth in broadband. But because we're talking about GIS, you know, think for the number of tiles that Google Earth needs to store. Think about the number of tiles, the number of image files that Google Maps need to store. You know, now it's vector maps, so it's different. But even when it was on the first version, you needed huge storage. And again, go back to 2000, and you are still in about $100 per gigabyte. You can't do Google Maps. By 2005, you are already at $1 per gigabyte, so you can do things very differently. That's why I'm saying that when you look at this trend, you take your knowledge about the industry, you can make sense of. There was something softer that was going on, which is web standards. So the web was HTML just and nothing else. And when you have things like XML and AJAX and other things that allow interactivity, it takes time for them to be absorbed. So look, for example, the interesting things about standards and how they stabilize. So remember 2000, it's the point where the selective availability of GPS become available. By 2002, people are already working on a standard called GPX, and by 2004, it stabilized. Now, the fact that the standard stabilized doesn't mean that you have access to it. It takes time for the industry to absorb it, to integrate it into different tools, for the software that you got from Garmin to include the ability to get the GPX out. But so again, we're getting again into this point in 2005, where these things are starting to be popular enough, available enough, and people can do them. The result of it is an explosion that happened with and the creation of this volunteer geographical information. So now we can look at some of the examples. This one is one really interesting one. When Google Earth came out, and this guy, Matt, decided to do a print screen to take out the image of the neighborhood where it grew, put it into Flickr, and Flickr at the time created the ability in JavaScript to define areas on the map and annotate it. What they thought about was what Facebook thought about later, of putting names of the people in the picture and things like that. What Matt has done is actually starting to tell stories about his life as a child. This is where I had my first kiss. This is where I was playing on the ground. And because of the availability of Google Earth and the availability of Flickr, within weeks from him putting the first image, lots of other people put in memory maps. And it's kind of interesting to look at that. Now, the issue with that is that memory maps are, of course, non-geographic, because the coordinates of them, trying to bring it back to the coordinates, will require you to register the image and register the rest of the information. But that's demonstrated how people innovate all by themselves. Other things that were based on the available services is things like Wikimapia, where you have an image that comes from Google Earth and people just digitize an area and give it a title, give it a description, or attach it to a web page and other things. So this is the type of VGI that rely on other services. Someone else provided the service, and you, the volunteers or the user-generated content is coming on top of that. Geograph is more active one. And it's the combination between a game and taking photos. So take your own place to the UK, break it into the national grid. Each grid square got the famous two characters and four numbers. Let's now get an image of each square kilometer, or a lot of them in order to characterize it. It's supported by the OS. You can see 82% coverage nowadays, 4.2 million images. It's, by the way, a fantastic resource to do all sorts of research in characterizing the look and the area of different places and so on. And one of the famous examples of this whole trend in this user-generated content is, of course, OpenStreetMap. A lot of times people confuse that to VGI, but it's important to realize that it's different. VGI is much more than OpenStreetMap. So OpenStreetMap started because of the frustration of Steve Coast after he finished his degree at UCL, that he can't get access to maps that he could as a student. He started by collecting some data with the GPS and thinking that it's possible to do that. That didn't really work. The moment that Yahoo allowed the community to start digitizing on top of your own map, the whole thing took off, and the rest is history. But what is also very interesting is that you even see it in companies. So while Google Mapmaker, a project that started in India for Google, was really insignificant even in 2008. So look at the number of places. So in red there you see all the places where Google went to someone else to buy data to produce maps. LiveTech, Teleatlas, one of those global providers. By 2012, all these places where you see blue, it's user-generated maps. In other words, it's places where the revenue for Google doesn't justify buying good maps from Teleatlas. In all the other places, a lot of places where you see the green, is the street view cars going around and doing the mapping for Google also. So you see a transition there. The blue is the most important thing for our discussion, because you see actually that Google is relying also on user-generated. But there is another trend. So the last trend that we kind of see in this VGI is this thing, where the smartphones, so in the International Telecommunication Union, when they are talking about active mobile broadband subscription, practically they are talking about smartphones, because function phone can't do broadband. So, and you can see that in the developed world, somewhere around 2010, about 5 years ago now, we are passing again the 40%, so it's starting to be a mass participation element, and you get it in different places. So that enables you to do things like this, checking into different pubs and places, Foursquare, where you record the different information of what you've done. Or another interesting example of this ability from the smartphone is Waze, where the participants are actually reporting where they are. If you look carefully, you see on this image that some bits of the maps are with dots, and that if you are playing the game and you drive through this road, you can get all kind of things like that, a yummy bonus and all kind of aspects of gamification. So to kind of recap on that, despite the fact that it started around 2005, the recognition came around 2007 with Guccian. It's also known under other names, user-generated geographical content, crowdsourced geographical information, lots of other things, and we'll look at the specific thing of citizen science. But it's a lot of things that are included in it. So remember that it's the range from Wikipedia to annotating existing information to collecting the information itself. It's got this variety of sources of information. Some of them are more qualitative, some of them are more quantitative, some of them coming from instrumental records. So let's look at a specific type. Now we are moving into the second part, which is about citizen science. And then we'll see the overlap between them. So this is fairly fresh off the print. It kind of came up in the Oxford English Dictionary and accepted as a term in June 2014. And it defined what citizen science is. So this is citizen science, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is scientific work undertaken by members of the general public, often in collaboration with or under the direction of professional scientists and scientific institutions. Okay. So participation, a version of the term in the US, they tried a bit to use it, they tried to call it public participation in scientific research. But actually, it's not new. And a lot of people being involved in science before you even had the term science, the term scientist was only coined in 1830, around that period. And before that, you had, and even after that, you have amateur naturalists, and you have amateur astronomers, and you have bird watchers, and all the rest of it. Mary Anning is a good example of that, where she contributed significantly to both paleontology and also to geology, but because she got three things wrong. She got the wrong gender, she got the wrong religion, and she got the wrong class. And for that, you are punished by not being a member of the Royal Geological Society and also other things. You just go away. And interestingly, people would use her finding and put it under their name for someone from outside the UK that gave her some credit during her life, and she's much more respected nowadays. But the point is that it's been in the background of science and continue to be in the background of science all the way through. So this is, for example, from a report from the World Meteorological Organization, where it's an observer going out and checking precipitation in the outback in Australia. Now, considering that the area, the Tanami Downs, got about 250 millimeter a year on average, then it's something to do every morning at 9 o'clock, go and do nothing. 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 Oh, nothing. And so on until, you know, something happened. But that's an interesting one. Another one that is very famous is the Christmas Bell Count, which we just had passing, where it's running across the US. Originally started as a way to divert people from shooting birds to do something else with them. And that was the society created, this whole observation. Now there are something like 70,000, even more people across the US going out observing birds and reporting them. And this thing has been going on for more than 100 years. And of course, this thing has been going on for almost 300 years. thing has changed. So the same way that this thing that I told you about the VGI change, all these things that I showed you, these technological changes that have been going on and changed the landscape of VGI, also hit this area just as much. And it's important to realize that something happened with that, so we can call it, you know, just for comparison, we call it citizen science 2.0. You know, it's a great term. And the difference are the levels of education, the ability to standardize, the technology that we've seen, and the DIY electronics. So the first one, which I find, again, as if you want kind of a mega trend that could really change the picture, it's this thing. The fact that if you were doing citizen science, so you're doing meteorological observation in the 1950s, the number of people that had higher education of any kind, not just science, any higher education, was something like 2% of the population, 5%. By today, we're talking about 1 in 4, close to 9 in 4, okay? Which means that the number of potential participants, it's huge. It's not like what you had in the past. And worldwide, this trend is just, it is a mega trend in terms of the change that is caused to the population of the world. So there are, that's prediction to total people in tertiary education. Just for comparison, you see on the top the line of the growth of general population, so you see that the speed of higher education is faster than the speed of total population growth, and there are already predictions of 250 million students. And also remember that because we are looking at higher education, every 3 years we've got people coming out and joining in the group of people who go to be around. And that's one of the nice expressions of it that I like, that demonstrate that something is changing in society, something called the Flynn effect, which is appearing by James Flynn, who was throughout his career arguing against IQ tests and said IQ tests are measuring just what IQ tests are doing and they are biased towards scientific thinking. But what he was showing me in his analysis is the overall gain of about 3 IQ points every 10 years throughout the developed world. So people became smarter, and the only way to, if you are believing IQ, would say that they became smarter. Now that's ridiculous, because according to this analysis, you would end up with realizing that your grandparents were somewhere around 70, which will make them basically retarded or something in that area, that's really deficient. Now that doesn't make any sense. And it's showing in his analysis, and you can see a very nice talk of him on TED and other places, that what's going on is that as society became much more abstract, realism more, you know, removed from money, for example, as notes, to virtual money, credit cards, and also other things that are going around society. What society has done is it's pushing people towards the thing that you test measure. We are losing things in the process, and that's another issue, but there is the whole thing going on. The final element, and that's a very nice one, is all this DIY electronic, this accessibility to lots of things that will allow you to change things and hack things and change them and build them. Raspberry Pi is a famous one in the UK. Arduino is another example. You can buy this kit in a shop and by the afternoon you've got a temperature and humidity sensor for £25. So all these things created a new era of citizen science. And you have this re-emerging, but and François Gray, a guy from Geneva, from CERN, calling it citizen cyber science, which is this citizen science facility on the internet. And let's now look at the types of it, because that's the bit where, same way that I showed you different types of VGI, there are also different types of citizen science. So we'll go through the different aspects of it, the biological or observational reporting, volunteer computing, volunteer thinking. I'll explain what each one of them is. So biological recording and conservation information is the thing that I told you been going on just forever in citizen science, and sometimes hundreds of years. But here's the big difference. The moment you go into a system like eBird, actually the system itself push you to record the information in certain way in the forms. even if they allow you to get your information. If in the past you would get 10 burdens and their life list was held in different notebooks, maybe there was someone, you know, entrepreneurial and producing notebooks that several burdens would use at the same time, but generally each person would record it slightly different because they were doing that. The moment they're starting to use that, you get standardization of records. Forget about the quality, just the record itself. It's standardized, it's easier to handle. It's actually easier to transmit, and also it's digital, so it's easier to replicate and do other things with. And a study in 2012 across the UK showed 237 programs running in different parts of the country, and there is growing. And the example from the person you see over there, Jonathan Silvertown, and I've got also a picture here on the image, is iSpot, and it's showing something really interesting. iSpot is an app that exists on the web, but also exists on your mobile phone. You can go around and you see a species or you see something that you don't know, you take a picture of it and you ask people, what's that? What did you say? And then usually within an hour you get a classification within whatever. Right?
Yeah.
And it allows you, that just an example here from Edinburgh of getting the information. I have also my personal experience of seeing a moth in the living room, and my partner asked me, will it eat our clothes or not? So I said, I don't know what species it is. I took a picture of it, and within 2 hours, the answer was, yes, it is. So other examples of these online apps is things like MySoil, which is a BGS application that allows you to record different characteristics of soil and record geological and geographical information. So that kind of observation, you see that although we are talking about ecological observation, which, as I said, going back hundreds of years, it's different now with these new forms of citizen science. Volunteer computing is the next one, and that one is purely possible because of the internet and the broadband, the data, and all the things that I showed you in the first part. So volunteer computing is inherently you download an application that runs on your computer in the background and doing some processing that helps scientists. And a good example from 2014 was the work that in Oxford they wanted to get a quick answer. What were the floods that we experienced the result of climate change, how much we can attribute it to climate change. And they had something like 30,000 models that helped them to create the different predictions and to get to the conclusion that yes, there is actually an element of it. I think in the report that you can see about 20% or 25% that they can relate to climate change. And the interesting thing is that now these applications are being ported into mobile phones. So your mobile phone is sitting next to your bed each night being charged and not doing anything for something like 6 hours. Now, it's not a processor, it's not storage, it can do things. And that's something that, for example, application like Point Cloud is starting to offer, that it downloads the data, really send it back, and that enables people to create supercomputer, distributed supercomputing at a very large scale. Specifically for geography, there are really interesting examples like QuakeCatcher, where you got the application running on, say, on MacBooks and on ThinkPad computer, they got accelerometer inside them in order to recognize if the computer is being dropped. They are using it in order to create a seismic network that your computer, in case of an earthquake, report back what it says. And that's actually become locational information. They thought about using smartphones also, but they don't, because the smartphone will jump too much if it's a serious earthquake. So it's not really reliable source of information. The next type that is also only available because of the internet and because of the amount of data that is possible to send and receive is this thing of volunteer computing. So volunteer computing, volunteer thinking, sorry. Previous one was volunteer computing. Volunteer thinking is using what's called cognitive surplus, the fact that we have, you know, we're playing Angry Birds or kind much now, instead of doing something more useful. So that's the more useful thing that you can do. You can classify galaxy, you can listen to bats, you can, what else? You can look at old records of ships in order to report weather. You can do, try to figure out papyri, all sorts of things you can do with that. And there is also applications like this, like cloud crafting, which allow anyone to build their own apps very quickly. And that allows you to classify information. So what you do is you basically get a large group of volunteers that go through the information and go through very simple or sometimes not that simple classification tasks. And they provide the information back. And because you have so many volunteers, you send each task to 3 volunteers and see how good they are. Or in the case of galaxies, we develop all kinds of machine learning and other algorithms where they recognize how good is the volunteer, how serious they are. And that allowed them, by sending them some images that they know been classified well, and that allowed people to assess how good is the data. So there are all kind of interesting things going on in this area. The next area is that overlap both the DIY science and the civic science, community sciences. This example from a group called the Public Laboratory of Open Technology and Science. And they created, after the reason for the group to come apart was the big oil spill in New Orleans. And when there was the spill, people wanted to take an aerial photo, and there wasn't any way to do that. So they took a balloon attached to it, some cheap camera. The camera was strapped with a rubber band, took the images all the way. Then you can take all the images, stitch them together, and create an aerial image. And it actually helped the community to monitor the oil spill. But since then, they developed lots of other DIY techniques that allow communities to deal with issues that concern them. So this is, for example, a picture taken in Jerusalem where a Palestinian community have an issue with the road that has been built in the middle of the area, and they wanted to have the evidence of what the disruption that was caused. So they lift up a balloon, same technique, now it's easy to do, and they stitch all the information together. They're also using now an application called MapMeter that allows you to take all these diverse images and stitch them into something common. Here you see also the example of how the balloon mapping looks like. And in order, because there is an issue with the amount of helium that exists that is concerned about, overuse of helium, public lab also developed kites. So if you have no kites now, that can also be too. Another example of this community-based science is air quality issues. So in air quality issues, there are lots of techniques that exist in the 70s, and now they are cheap. Things like diffusion tubes or wipe sampling that allow people to just wipe a bit from hard surface and then send it to the lab, and then you can analyze it for heavy metals. And that's a technique that's been proven in many parts of London, carried out with my community. Or the other one that my group, and that's where the extreme citizen science comes from, is working with pygmy hunter-gatherers in the Congo Basin. And they've asked the anthropologists to work with them. Can you provide them an app to monitor illegal poaching? The reason they asked for the app is because they've been involved before that with another app that was doing about resource management. So they asked something specific for illegal poaching. If you look very carefully, you'll see here that in the app. The app was designed in a participatory process together with the tribe, and it can be used in different ways. And as we speak, actually, some members of my team are in the Congo Basin working with some communities. So to kind of finish this thing about the elements of citizen science and VGI, this is a VGI-centric view of the overlap. So we've seen that VGI include all sorts of things, from OpenStreetMap to checking to different places, to taking photographs to others. Some bits of VGI can be very clearly defined as citizen science. So OpenStreetMap, for me, fall very neatly into citizen science. Why? Because it's about repeatable observation, it's about something that you can validate, it's about collecting just facts. So OpenStreetMap doesn't collect non-facts, it collects things that you can observe in reality, and it's using things like GPS and other scientific techniques in order to record it. So it's very similar to going after a certain species and recording where it is. And the techniques are very similar. On the other hand, using untapped in order to record when you go to the pub, that's not citizen science. Okay? Or Foursquare, I would say, more out of the scope. On the other hand, when we look at the things that I told you about citizen science, there are interesting things. So this whole biological recording, this whole ecological observations, very strongly based on geography. The ecologists and the environmentalists who are concerned with it, they create atlases of distribution and all the rest of it. All this information is collected by volunteers, and it is very clearly joining it. Also, the community civic science is an area where you have a very clear overlap, because when communities come together to deal with an issue, lots of times there are communities of place with a specific concern about working together. So there is a lot of overlap there, and that's been going on in the past 50 years. The volunteer thinking, however, there is a very small area where it overlaps with VGI. So there are examples where, for example, UNITAR got in one of the EU projects that we're working in called Citizen Cyber Lab, a project where they collect images about an area that is in difficulty zone. There is an emergency there, say Syria or a place that had a flood or something like that. And then they use volunteers to look at the images and classify them and tell them what it is. And they look at the exit, for example, or try to record exactly where it is. So that's an example of volunteer thinking that is used for geography. But most of it is not linked to geographical thinking. Volunteer computing, I gave you an example of where it overlaps, where it catches on other things. But most of the volunteer computing, it's about cracking proteins to find AIDS and things like that. So it's not having much overlap. And the DIY science is similar. Okay? And the size of the blocks should give you also an idea about the size of the communities. So in terms of biological recording, it probably needs to be, it's very dedicated community all over the world, really collecting data for a very long time. The volunteer computing, although it precedes volunteer thinking, what happened is that because it requires more technical skills, download something, trust that you can download it, and you're not inserting viruses to your computer, knowing how to deal with the technical issue. It's a smaller community than the number of people that join in the volunteer thinking type activities. So now we move to the last two parts of the talk, where I want to talk about what geoscience, what we as geoscientists and people who come from GIS can contribute to this area of citizen science, what kind of things we can do. And I'll cover this issue of data quality assurance, spatial analysis method, geovisualization, ontologies, and all the semantic interoperability, but also standard human-computer interaction and social tone aspects. Let's look at that. Data quality assurance. There are already quite a lot of papers looking at data quality in volunteer geographical information. And some of these techniques can move very neatly into the area of citizen science. But it's also the other way around. So there are, for example, six methods that have been identified that can be used for different types of quality assurance. For example, this ability that you have multiple people observing the same area, and that gives you confidence that it's correct. Or creating gatekeepers and moderators that working through the system and checking what the data that people inserting. Geographical, so we take geographical principle, what we know about the behavior of geography, and use that in order to predict things. So for example, if you know about the river network, you can expect to see certain observations in certain places, and if you don't see them, you know that something is missing. And those three appear really did a good job in the paper, that's what it's taken from, it's the paper of 2012, to which I'm saying that you actually need to add three more quality assurance procedures. The first one is domain knowledge. So as we've seen, in each of the observations that you have, ecology, air quality, and other things, there is a specific domain knowledge that can help you to write algorithms to check if the data is good or not, and to figure out how to do it. The next one is instrumental observation. We are using these devices, that's why the GPS is so important for me, because the moment you got it in the instrument, and you got an exit image that gives you the information, then you know that it's accurate. The number of people on the average population that can tamper with exit file is extremely small. Okay? And you can expect, therefore, that the information is very correct. And finally, what you see a lot in citizen science is procedures. So the fact that you kind of force gently and encourage, whatever you want to call it, the user to go through specific procedures. And there are some really lovely applications that are doing that. So if you are interested in Ladybird, just look at the Ladybird survey application and you'll see from a design perspective how it guides you through a specific procedure. The next area is things like spatial analysis that, for example, that's from the work of Thomas Kuklesis that looks at OpenStreetMap and look at how good it is when you compare it to ordnance survey data. And when you look at the matching percentage, for example, you see that in the center of London, it's just as good as master map. And as you go to the edges, you get less. Those type of insights that are take into account the heterogeneity of the data is something that geoscience know how to do it. You know, think about geographically weighted regression and all sorts of other things. And those things can contribute to analysis in citizen science. Next one is this image is coming from eBird, the Cornella ornithology image, showing you the distribution of the painted bunny. And they've got lots of other images there. They just take what you see here is all the amounts of observation that they had over 2008, and they're very lucky. They're getting millions of records all the time. But they keep on showing that. If you go to any presentation on citizen science coming from Cornell, at some point you'll see this image. Is that the only geovisualization that we can do with it? Is that the one that makes more sense? Is that the one that correct? All these kind of things, again, there is knowledge in GIS, in cartography, and can be used. But it is amazing to look at. And I would recommend it to those of you. The next aspect where GIS science is good at, it's this whole interoperability issue. So that's a really interesting aspect. There is a big effort of the EU Biodiversity Observation Network and things like system like GDIF and other things to try and share data. And there is a lot of discussion there, whereas in the area of GIS, as demonstrated in the EU project one actually from Edina, Cobweb, there are examples that you can see that when people coming from GIS files, they kind of went through all the pain of figuring out how you work with standards already 10 years ago. So we looked at OGC, we sort of, not that we like it best, and not that personally I don't think that the API should be much easier to use and all the rest of it, but at least we know how to approach these things. And you can see kind of the different bits coming together. That's an interesting example of that. So that's an area where GSI is clearly cool. The kind of other aspect is the social issue and the societal aspect that geographers, again, because of their ability to look at the physical and the human, can do lots of things. So those are the million people who participate in this volunteer thinking project called Zooniverse. But don't look at the bright spots, look at the dark spots. And you see that large chunks of the world, for example, the inequality going on there. Like, look at how all parts, you know, huge part of the world just uncovered and even in, you know, China doesn't belong to the US, but access to the internet and access to resources and so on. Or take the idea of what community to read, where, and that's actually quite common to open source and other things, how to present mail, high level of education, other things, how do we reach out to other groups. So that sort of things, again, participatory geographies and other things from the background of GIS can help. On the interaction side, we, again, from the work of my group, that's from Julia Altenbuchner, who is currently flying drones somewhere in the Congo Basin. How you develop an interface that a non-literate user, after they collected the data, can look at and analyze. So she, for example, suggested that the same interface that we use to collect the data will be used to visualize the information. So that's how one of the villagers go around and collect data about fruit in the area. If they click on one of these, she suggested that it would bring it down and allow them to see the information. Then they go to another bit of the data and ask where they got the crocodiles and see the information. But it's all prototypes that we're going to try all the time. Now, you know, we talked about the human-computer interaction, distributed mobile geographical technologies, cognitive aspects of place. So that's an area where those of people in geographical information science and systems that are interested in cognitive aspects of place and space are really interesting case to check how the participation in citizen science changed the way people perceive the environment around them. And data mining and spatial temporal analysis is of course something that we can do. And I always raise this kind of all this heavy literature that exists because of the link of geography between the physical and the human on trust, privacy, ownership, all of these other things. So we've seen what GIS science could do to citizen science. Let's look why GIS scientists should be really interested in doing things with citizen science. And that's why. We'll look at longevity of VGI data sources, the scale, the challenges that it offers, critical issues, usability challenges, and the opportunity for interdisciplinary collaboration. This is the first paper that talked about, used the term citizen science in the modern times. It's from 1989, and talked about the Audubon Society, where they had 225 volunteers collecting acid rain examples. But as I showed you, there are data sets going back 100 years. Now, OpenStreetMap, it's 10 years. You know, it's still, and I can tell you from engagement with the community that a lot of the people that started it, still the children are not as big that they are still having the time to go to the pub and spend time with their mates and go around mapping. It will be interesting to watch what happened to OpenStreetMap in the next 5 years as the kids grow up and want more time when you go on holiday. That's, you know, those are open questions about the modern VGI or how long Wikimafia will continue to operate or what happened to Foursquare when it's merged into Facebook. All these kind of things are in flux. Whereas when you're looking, if you want to understand how long can someone do VGI, look at something called the Biological Record Center in the UK, where you find people recording for 50 years. Every year they're going out and recording things, or the British Trust of Ornithology, where people have been walking the same field for 20 years, recording the information. Question about how they collected, how things changed, all the rest of it, it's there. Just go and look at it. The next thing that the citizen science gives you is scale. Which is really surprising. So that's the example I showed you, the air quality example of the work that we're doing in London. We started it in 2009, 10, and then another community asked us to do that. Some of them gave us a bit of money. We done it with two more communities. Then another charity picked it up, started to do it also by itself. Another one done that. And in the end, we actually got now over 25 cases in London of all using very similar methods of community-based air quality monitoring. That sort of scale of activity is something that It's very rare within, say, the participatory GIS literature where you have a very small case study. As a researcher, citizen science enables you to do things at scale and increase the reach of adaptivity in all sorts of interesting ways. You also have really interesting data sets. So GBIF is an open access of supposedly free data sets that is being collected from across the world about biodiversity records. They got also already over 500 million records, although a big chunk of that is e-birds that I showed you earlier from Cornell. But still, you got your variety, you got your issues of ontology, you got your, actually, in the ontology area, if you think that semantic interoperability between, say, two types of engineering is a problem, you haven't seen nothing yet when you're talking about ecology or about different branches of biology and how they talk with one another. There is lots of interesting and very juicy problems about this issue and different names for species between different countries, between different cultures. How do you solve all these things is something that you can find only in that area. Now, doing something that really matters is also important. That's a slide that I took from Ellen Roy from the CEH. And you can see invasive species can be 12 billion euros a year impact on the EU. There are areas where you can do things like that, but citizen science does offer you an opportunity to work on things that really matter. And there is plenty of that, really, really plenty. There are also fascinating usability challenges. So I showed you what we are doing. So the reason, for example, that I started working with Jerome Lewis, who is doing the work in the Pongo Basin, was that he came and said, I want to have a GIS that the pygmy hunter-gatherers can use in the forest. And the answer was, yes, when we start. It took us another 4 years to start. But inherently, that's, and we have really interesting experiences about interaction with geographical technology, about new usability challenges, about, for example, one of the most interesting things that we have at the moment is that the society that he's working with are what's called egalitarian society, where nobody owns anything. So the phone is not owned by an individual, it's owned by the group. And how do you deal with the situation where multiple people are going to enter information on the same application, and what do you want to do? Do you want to take a picture every time you recognize a tape record or a session starts? All sorts of things like that are coming up just because we're doing this type of thing. One of the last ones that is really fascinating for me is what happened. I'm demonstrating it here in two books about where we started. So in 1993, if you go back to the history of GIS research and when it was still a young field, there was a whole series of conferences on GIS and environmental modeling where people from the whole environmental sciences and ecology and all this area came together with GIS people to figure out how you start creating the hydrological modeling in GIS, especially it rolled into what you see now in GIS. How do you do procedural modeling and all the rest of it. Today, we actually have two branches, and you actually get spatial analysis for ecologists, and another one is the book that some of you might have came across, which is dedicated to GIS scientists. The kind of the bin separation between the two areas. And actually, there is an opportunity to bring things together and have these fascinating conversations about what's happening in their area, how do they make sense of data, what do we make sense of data, where we learn to work together, what we can do, and how we can bring things back. So and the distance is not huge, so it's still possible to conflict. The other issues that you can use citizen science as part of GIS science research are things like understanding motivation, practices, engagement, all these kind of other things, and see that where it's similar to VGI, where it's different from VGI, so on. You can think about new techniques and data sources. So I just mentioned to you things like drones that fly through the forest and try to record data. But things about DNA geotyping, going around and recording, say, lightning or something else, where you swap it, collect it. what would that look like? It's still too expensive, by the way, the data analysis, to allow that, but let's say within the next 10 years, the cost is probably will drop down to some degree, and it will be possible to do things like that. What will we do with that? What are we going to do with that? Camera traps is something that ecologists are using quite a lot, of putting a camera with a target that detects images well, or sensor motion detection. We can, you know, what difference does that tell us and how we use it? And the other things that you can do is when you're talking with the people who are involved in synthetic science and we've done this work also, is to notice how the task, and the task is complex. It's really requiring quite a lot of effort on the cognitive side when you're looking at a species or trying to take a good picture of an egg bird. All these things do take attention, and it's kind of interesting things because usually a lot of the literature on spatial cognition is kind of giving very simple tasks. We focus a lot on navigation. We don't have a lot of use cases where people are doing something really complex in a spatial context, and that's an opportunity to do that. So I hope that I convince you now that there is kind of, in both directions, there are really interesting interactions. And basically, to summarize, I hope that I convince you that the trends are not just invented, they actually do mean something, and they do tell you that something is different in both the way people generate geography and people do citizen science. And geoscience can and should contribute to citizen science, and citizen science can open a new direction to geoscience. And you are placing one of the best places in the world where CIPA is just announced about a year or two ago that citizen science is going to be the center of their approach to monitoring the environment and working. So you even got an open door of someone that will collaborate with you, which not a lot of places and people go. So I hope that you'll use it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? I think Chris was first. Cameron.
Hi. I used to work in the public sector, and I was very much involved in the public sector making decisions about data and information that was good for our citizens. I'm now a citizen. And what I'm very interested in is how the public sector can give me data and information that actually is relevant to me and that I can use and that I can contribute to. And it seems to me, certainly here in Scotland, that as far as citizens being able to engage with our public sector with data and information to allow us to make a difference. Scotland is not very good at that. So you've given us lots of examples here about engagement. A lot of it is engagement at an academic level, engagement at a project level. But in terms of a government engaging with its citizens to do good stuff based on citizen knowledge, I'm not quite sure we're at that stage yet, certainly up here, and I'm just wondering if you could give us any handy tips or hints that we can move it forward.
So as I said, it's actually here more than other places in the environmental sector, really. At least that's what all the documents that are coming from CIPA are stating. And there are good examples of that, you know, it's called the Riverfly Foundation, I think, if I'm getting it right, where they basically engage anglers to start monitoring different streams because it's much more effective and they've got strong interest in making sure that the streams are in good health. And it's a process that was designed together with the anglers in order to ensure that the information is something that they want to do, that they can do fairly easily and accordingly as So that's one good example. Another example that there is a problem about which direction it goes in on a more mundane level on the DGI side is Fix My Street, where you go around, you see a pothole or something like that, and you report to the government. The most cases of that project is started by Mass Society in England and it's spreading around, and there is a version of it. Different places, the question about it is to what degree you do get the feedback back. Now, also there is an interesting process that local authorities go through. So when we started doing the air quality studies, the first place where we done that was in Lewisham in London. And after we finished doing that, we got 4 pages Word document from the local environmental officer telling us that we went. What we got is wrong, because you shouldn't, you know, you how they're basically, he was upset that we're using diffusion tubes, which is the technique that he uses, something like that. And he didn't want to lose the authority. The authority and control was a very important thing. And the way to solve it with that officer was to inherently explain that it's not a threat on his job. Nobody is going to take his job away. Actually, the citizens of Kitsa State, where we've done that, want to make sure that someone is looking after them. And they can't do it forever. They want the officer to be aware and put some equipment in their area, which he did, and everything worked. Today the Mapping for Change social enterprise that we run launched a report which detailed a whole year of project that was done in the Barbican. By now, it was already commissioned by the City of London environmental officer. They actually funded it, followed it through, and were very pleased that the citizens themselves of the Barbican became more aware of what are the issues that need to be dealt and actually provide both political and practical support to the environmental officer in doing that. What happened over these 5 years of transition? They said that it's not threatening, that it's something that is respecting their position, that it's something that is done in collaboration and not in as a way to confront them. And all these elements help. And we also, now if you Google it, you can find a report that we published for the World Bank called Crowdsourcing Geographical Information in Government that looks exactly at this issue, a little bit example of where it is. Another trick in the book, which is true for anyone who's been in GIS since the 80s, will know this trick, find your champion. So find someone who is willing to start thinking about how to do that. If that person is willing to do it and stretch the system a bit, then it could do things. And we've seen it in different places around the world.
Thank you.
That's one level where people are very familiar with their area. But issue, for example, about these volunteers in British Trust of Ornithology, who are doing these transects in fields for 20 years. We can go and look at the same area. There are lots of, in the biological recording center, people who observe certain ponds of certain site, special scientific interest, and all these other things. They develop all sort of relationship and familiarity about the area and ability to recognize changes in the area. I just think that that level of understanding of place at different scale is something that I haven't seen. I'm not super in this area, but I haven't seen a lot of work that looks at these more complex tasks within this context. There is loads of literature on navigation, which seem to be, you know, what people need to do around measurement navigation. Let's do research on that. That type of more, you have less examples of more spatially complex tasks. And that's a good example for that.
Sorry, I don't want to hog it, but I think one of the issues that I find very, very interesting is this whole issue of data quality. And I think that you alluded to there, because somebody has walked the transect line for 20 years, then, you know, the data that comes from them is probably very good because they know what's going on. And I think this is one of the problems that a lot of public sector organisations have, that they get very, very precious about their data, particularly if it's driven, and I hesitate to say it in the room full of GI techies, but particularly if it's driven by GI techies who want 120% accuracy and precision all the time, before they would release any data. And of course, anything coming in from a citizen is immediately suspect because they didn't do it. Yeah. Now, we do have some very, very good examples here in Scotland, and you know, I think there's one guy sitting in this room here who I would praise to the heavens in terms of what they're doing in terms of the Royal Commission for Ancient and Historic Monuments, where they have got a very, very good scheme of different levels, if you like, of data quality assurance. But the point is that they make it available. So I can make a decision. So I can see Historic Scotland Inspector created that data, you know, really, really, probably pretty good. Cameron Easton, you know, Citizen created that data. Not too sure about it, but it's a nice photograph. So I think there are ways that we can get around this data quality thing, you know, by putting appropriate filters, if you like, in place. But we must get the data out there. We must get it out so people can
see it
and use it.
So my, you know, I'll give you the provocative version. I've got two versions of answering it, because data quality is always in citizen science is the thing that comes. And VGI is the first question usually that comes in the after talks. So my provocative version of the answer is all data is heterogeneous, just that some data is more honest about it than other data. So let's take ordnance survey data. Anyone who's been around and talked with ordnance survey know that in rural area, some bits of it, even with the improvement, it's still the story about the hunger, you know, when they've done it in the 1950s, of cutting the maps and stretching them when they move the projection. And that's how they demonstrated, for example, that I don't remember who was it, the geomagic group or someone else, kind of manipulate their data around the organization. So they knew that their data is not good. They actually knew that they manipulated in rural areas. So what's going on is that even for the ordnance survey and even for anybody, what you do is you download Mastermind, and it tells you about the data. You can look at the metadata for each object and about when it was collected. But you have this assumption that everything is okay. And actually, the update cycle and where the person was and when it was and all this kind of information is not hidden. The data is actually telling you, trust me, because I'm authoritative. Now, citizen science data, VGI, shout at you from the moment you go and touch it, you know, check me. see what it is, check who it is. Because, for example, you gave the example of the inspector and the citizen. Now let's dig a bit into it, and you discover that the citizen is the is a history teacher with a degree from the university in history, and he's been the chair of the local historical society for the past 30 years. Whereas the inspector been sacked after 2 years because he was slacking and basically putting all kind of shoddy reports. That can happen, but at least you know that you are looking at this part in this way. So that's why I'm saying that all data is heterogeneous, that some data is honest about it. So I hope that, you know, it's not saying that there is, it's another version of it is to go on the, there is no authoritative data yet on it, so that kind of version. But it's all data is heterogeneous.
Just one in there, I'll let Bruce have the final word.
One of the things you don't take into account is what the actual motivation of the people who are collecting this data is. You describe citizen science. If you speak to other people who are collecting this data, it's a form of activism for them. And that's an issue that can introduce systematic biases.
No. That's the second question that we get from the activity. And the point about it is that, let's take the quality of the diffusion tubes. Unless you're going to put in a generator just under it and operate it for the whole month, which they don't, you would get exactly the data that someone else is doing. One of the advantages of science is that it doesn't matter what your motivation. If science is objective, factual-based, and other things, and the data itself, if it's coming from instrumental observation,
people setting up these networks for air quality monitoring, the people who buy the kits to set up their local station have choices about where they locate it.
Absolutely, but as long as they're following and giving you the information, you can analyze for the biases. So the whole thing, and we've seen it, I'm not just saying that it's not. We've seen it in the Barbican and in the Pizza State and in many other places. That what's going on is that science, actually, the fact that we're using scientific method, it takes out from the equation a debate about what it is, that it's just, I'm complaining that it's very polluted here. And the local authorities say it's not polluted here. Or a good example was in Patna, where there was a junction, it was very busy, the local population was saying it is polluted there, TfL said it's dispersing, no problem there. They took diffusion tubes, put it according to the standard, filled the area, done the monitoring for 2 months, demonstrated to TfL that the level of pollution is indeed above the standard, TfL changed the buses. Okay, that's one of our success cases in this context. But because it's diffusion tubes that you can compare to other data, and you can compare to other information, you can, even if we're talking about the monitoring station that people buy, you can check how good it is. So, for example, everyone in the area of air quality now know that the current generation of small air quality monitoring, air quality ag and smart citizen kit, are just producing rubbish. And people are saying that, and even the volunteers themselves, the people who collect it, the people behind this project are saying the same thing, and are exploring what they can do to improve it. So there is something really fascinating going on also on that aspect between the activism and the other things. And having multiple observers, there are all these kind of data quality techniques to deal with that. But that's also an interesting angle on that.
Okay, nearly drinks time, but Bruce, you want to follow up?
Yes, but you know, just interested if you had any comments on the, ownership issues and consequent ethical issues of these ownership issues of the data that's produced. Your example of geographical thinking immediately came to mind, a geographic example there of the transcription projects for census records that are used by genealogists, which are all done by volunteers. But certainly up in this part of the world, you're now charged quite a lot of money to get access to that. Yeah. And I find that actually rather unethical. I just wonder how the data is used.
So that's a really fascinating debate that is happening at the moment within all this community of citizen science and VGI. So VGI will be with the example of OpenStreetMap map where they insist that you have shared life. That's one example. And actually, current recent evidence that emerged about the motives of what Steve Coast wanted to do it. So he is now admitting that originally he wanted to close the project and have it like waste and go away with the data. You know, hey, thank you for helping me. I'm now, you know, laughing all the way to the back. It didn't work for him because the German came from open source communities and they were the major group within that who said, no, we are going on shared life. And there's still a kerfuffle going on about the OVDL and all the rest of it that you can find, but there is a reason behind that. And it's interesting to actually that they can be right in a certain way. And what's going on is that across this area, there are people who are saying, indeed, it's volunteer data, it should be made available to them. But then you have the issue, for example, of BTO, the British Transport Ornithology, who's making money from it. Not huge, but I look at their annual account, they are saying that they get about £100,000 per year for copyright and data right. Okay? They also produce books and atlases and other things. So you can't say that this whole 100K is just coming from there. And actually, as percentage of the budget, is just 3% of the total budget. But still, I assume that for the position of the data manager, that's valuable. That is one or two posts within BTO. Now, take it out. Where do we get the money from? Who is going to subsidize? So if we are treating it as a public good, you need to have a mechanism to fund it. That's actually sustainable. It's coming together with sustainability. So there is this kind of growing principle that the volunteers should be able to see the data that they have collected and see data from other things. So in another project that Jonathan has done, Evolution Megalab, once you submitted an evaluation or observation of a snail, you would get back information about what the observation in your area. That was a form of feedback of showing you what the data lift is, but the rest of the data just went to the silence, isn't it?
It's called database.
Yeah. So but how do you do, what do you do with the data? How you share it? Should it all go to GBIF and become available or should it be locked? It's question that link not just to the principles but also to the practical aspect and to the business model. And if you want to look at that, there is interesting stuff that is starting to emerge from the EU project that are called citizens observatories, where they're trying to figure out what should be the business models and how should we operate within that. So, and also the last bit that I would say with our forest community, we have the reverse situation where we want to give people the full control over the data, but we have to be in a situation where we don't even release it online. So if anyone wants to release it, it will be whatever was agreed between the anthropologists and the tribe when they discussed the data collection, that's it. That's what will happen to the data. And someone might come to us and say, you got detail of some elephants that we really need to preserve. And they'll come to us and we'll say, no, the tribe didn't agree to really to do so. So, and we will figure out ways to encrypt it in a way that protect it. So you have all sort of interesting issues there. And there are discussions about the ethical issues.
Just listening to that discussion, it occurred to me that academics writing and publishing papers based on volunteer data shouldn't be published in access journals.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm getting really, really pissed off now that there is a new book about OpenStreetMap going in Springfield. You know, £100 for a book about OpenStreetMap is not access. So you are absolutely right. That's one of the principles that I do apply to.
I heard encryption there. I think that's on the way out too, if David Cameron has his
yes.
way.
Yes. Anyway,
right.
I think that Obama and Gerard
let's not go there. That brings us, well, perhaps that discussion can be had over geodrinks. So that brings us nicely to geodrinks. So do come along. We will sort of take a pause, say some thank yous in a second. The next talk is the end of February, February 27th, I think. So we're with Chris Dibbin and talking about past life courses with birth certificates, death certificates, and all sorts of things. So we look forward to that. See you then. So thank you all for coming today. do please stick around and follow us over to the TV Library Bar and bring your friends. And it just remains, well, thank you to the volunteers for helping, and thank you to the man himself, to Mickey, for a very interesting talk. Thank you.